Four Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Bank, now serving you with two locations, a friendly bank in a friendly town. Now, here's your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is radio historian, collector, Ed Corcoran.
Well, tonight, Dick, we have with us a man who is known by his character, maybe even his regular name. His character was David Harding, the counter-spy. Does that conjure up any memories in your mind,
Dick? It certainly does. It certainly does. We're talking about Don McLaughlin. And, Don, it's good to have you with us today here on the Golden Age of Radio.
Good to be here. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You know, the name that perhaps more of our younger audience may be familiar with is Chris Hughes, because you've been starring on As the World Turns since 1956.
Right. Going into our 20th year. That's a long, nice piece of employment for an actor.
It certainly is.
Got the kids through college.
As a matter of fact, you probably said the very first words on that program,
yes,
Don.
Yes, I did. I said, "Good morning, dear," to my wife, Nancy, and I think that started it all off.
Well, television has been a very important part of your career, but it really all had its roots in radio, and that's what we want to talk about tonight. And to do that, I guess we have to go back to Iowa, where you were born and where you were educated.
Yes, I graduated from the University of Iowa, and I think I took one of the first radio courses ever given in college. It was a little bitty studio, and it was WSUI was the call letters, and the studio was about the size of this, and we did all kinds of drama. One of our projects each year was that we had to write, direct, and do all the sound effects and everything else for one program. And I remember I was stomping on orange crates and directing the actors and making wolf calls in the background, and I was busy as a bird dog. But it helped learn my trade a little bit.
I guess it did. Your wife had played a remarkable role in really influencing you to make radio your career, though, didn't
she? Yes,
she
did. No, we got married, and we were out in California, and we thought, well, we don't know too much about Hollywood, so we came back east, and I had worked in the Artist Bureau up at CBS, and I knew a little bit about radio as far as the back of the microphone scenes went, and she asked me, well, what would you like to do? And I said, the most fun I've ever had in my life was acting. She said, why don't you give it a try? So she went to work for the WPA at that time, and I earned my first year the sum of $11.88. It was not much income tax on that. But I tried, and I kept going, and it just kept getting a little better and a little better. And finally, we were making a living, and it's been good ever since.
I guess it has. You had to break into a sort of an inner circle, I would assume, did you?
Yes, there was a group that were doing most of the work, and it was kind of hard to break in. My first show, I remember I called my mother out in Iowa and said, you must listen to this. I'm playing a little part of a Confederate soldier. But the script happened to be too long, and they cut it down and cut it down until my mother listened in, and all she heard me do was to be a horse in the background of a cavalry scene. That's what I did. That was my first professional job. But it got better. Couldn't have gotten much worse.
Well, I guess not. But now we're talking about the 30s.
Yeah, that's right. 1934. Mm-hmm. It was the first. That was when that job was.
You were involved very much in soaps in the early days of radio, weren't you?
Well, yes, they had a lot of soaps in New York. A lot of them were in Chicago too, but there were a number of them, like Stella Dallas and Argyle Sunday and Kitty Foyle and what is that one, the Romance to Helen Trent After 30?
That's the one.
Yeah, Romance of Helen Trent. Yeah, that's Romance of Helen Trent. And I was on all those. I played heavies and lovers and businessmen and ministers or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a marvelous experience.
Was it a 7-day-a-week job?
At one stretch, sounds like I'm bragging, but at one stretch, for 7 years, I played 7 days a week without a vacation. And I did Chaplain Jim on Sunday, Gangbusters on Saturday, Counter Spy on Thursday night, and Road of Life in between, and went on and for 7 years without a day off. But I was young and excited, and I didn't mind it. I loved it.
I guess your wife must have put up with it, too.
I think my children wondered who I was once in a while.
Well, you consider yourself a radio actor or a stage actor at that time. That sometimes is a conflict of interest in that part of one's career.
Yes, there is. I was in the stage play, Fifth Column, for the Theater Guild in 1939. And I think if I had stuck to the stage, I probably would have had a lot more experience. But I was getting started in radio, and we were buying a house, and we were having children. And it was kind of nice to see that money coming in, and so I stayed with it. And it was fun. It wasn't hard work, and we were stealing money, really. And so we had a lot of fun.
Did I tell you, Don, that... you played a very important influence in my career.
What's that?
Well, here I was at Darien High School back in 1946-47 when we had career day. And Don McLaughlin, who lived in Darien at that time, Ed, was asked to come in and participate and tell people about radio as a career. And I was all eyes because here was Counterspy live in front of me. And I decided right then and there that I, too, was going to make it my career. It's all your fault.
I was going to say, if I hadn't spoken to you that day, you could have been a respectable banker instead of this this wandering gypsy you are now, huh?
That's true, but no, I have no regrets whatsoever.
Well, good. I'm glad I steered you on the right path.
Well, of course, I was just thinking, you know, at that time you were able to commute quite regularly into the city. I suppose that's one of the considerations that led you to live in that part of Connecticut.
Yeah, well, we wanted to... a home in the country with the kids and everything, and it was a very nice community. It was an hour out, and of course, you know, you go an hour a day, that's one, 2 hours a day coming back, that's 1/12 of your life. That's 3 months of, 1 month a year you're sitting on that train. Now, that's a lot of time. Mm-hmm. I should have written a novel, but no, I read the paper.
Well, we can't do everything. How long would your day tend to be?
Oh, they varied. Sometimes there would only be Road of Life or maybe one of the soaps or maybe two. We ran from one to another if we were lucky to have two parts in one day. And, you know, you'd get in at noon maybe and get out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. But on the other hand, if you had something in the morning and then you had Counterspy at night or maybe Death Valley Days, which had a live repeat in those days for the West Coast, you did a show at 8 o'clock at night and then you did one at 11:30 or something or 11 at night. For the West Coast, the identical show, you did it over again. And in that interim, people sometimes did strange things. I've held up my script and faced an actor and found out it wasn't the same actor that played the part in the first show. I don't know what he'd gone and done, but he wasn't back there.
Hadn't made it back.
But it was it could be a long day, and some days were short, but it was all fun.
Yeah, I imagine it was. But it must have been hard work, too.
Well, yes, it was. You had... mainly the worry of fluffing a line, and there were some fantastic ones done over the years. But I've always said that in radio, I think it was proved by the fact that a great many people succeeded in that field. You didn't have to be terribly good as an actor, not extremely talented, but you had to be fast. Because they'd throw that script at you in a soap opera, you'd read it once, the director would time this and come out and give you cuts like line 3, page 2, line 7, and then get all those cuts in 5 minutes and go on and dress it and maybe even do it then and there on the air. And you didn't have any time to fool around. You had to make a very quick decision as to how you were going to play a part. And if you made the right decisions, you worked again. And if you made the wrong decision, the director said goodbye.
I suppose that's the reason for the very small nucleus, because these people could always be counted on.
Yeah, that's right.
You
I think.
Job, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It was a matter of facility as much as anything else. I'm not downgrading. There were a lot of talented people there and on radio, many fine talents. But there was a facility that was more necessary than any other quality, I think, any other factor in being a radio actor.
Well, when we think about the soaps, there's one that I always associate you with, Don. That is Road of Life, when you were the famous Dr. Jim Brent, who never seemed to find his way into surgery. He was always looking for him.
Yeah.
Could you just tell us how you got that particular part? Because that was a real gem, wasn't it, a part?
Well, it was a lot of... It was a nice part to play. I had a marvelous director by the name of Walter Gorman for most of the time. And we had a grand time doing that show. It was originally started in Chicago. A man named Ken Griffin played it out there. And then for some reason or other, they decided they wanted to bring it to New York. And another actor played it for a while. And one of those strange agency decisions, he went on vacation, and when he came back, he wasn't playing the part, didn't even know he wasn't playing the part, and I was. Now, he didn't hold it against me because, you know, we all try to get a job when we get a job. But I played it for a number of years and had a nice long run on it. The sponsor was Does Everything. I don't know who it was. And I remember my first vacation after that seven-year span that I was talking about, we went to Guatemala, and they have an echo court in the old Mayan ruins where you're supposed to, it echoes. And some of the people in the party said, say something, and I couldn't think of anything. Finally, I screamed, does everything, and it came back, does. And I thought, well, a little advertising down here. It won't hurt, even if it
never hurt.
Isn't in Spanish.
Oh, would you like to hear one of those old Rotolife stories?
I would love to. I haven't heard one in many a year,
okay.
So let her rip.
Okay, here we go.
Road of Life, brought to you, transcribed by Ivory Soap, now celebrating its 75th anniversary as America's favorite. Now we invite you to listen to The Road of Life, written by Charles Gusman. Since Hugh Overton and Francie left them shortly before midnight, Jocelyn and Jim have lingered near the outdoor grill behind the house on Almshouse Road, staring at the dying embers of the fire and talking scarcely at all, but aware of each other and of the special meaning an approaching moment has for them. The winds of the night, favorable to the occasion, bring the sound of the midnight tolling from a distance of almost a quarter mile to signal the moment.
Happy anniversary, darling. I love you.
Oh, Jim, this has been the happiest year I've ever known, and I love you more every day.
Happiest year for both of us. It's only the first one. Happy 1 a.m., darling.
Oh, what I do to you. You don't even know what time it is.
Hey, look, A.M. is an abbreviation of Anno Maritas, number one year of our marriage.
I see. Is Maritas Latin for marriage?
Could be.
You just made it up, though, hmm?
Don't see any Latins around to correct me. It suits me.
Suits me, too.
The word or the marriage?
Both.
Hold your lips that way.
Both.
Happy anniversary, darling. Or did I ever say that before?
I don't know. I don't even know where I am.
No. Well, then here is a reminder.
Oh, you're breaking a rib. I didn't tell you to stop. Just letting you know what you're accomplishing. Breakaway.
Let's do the breakaway, the something shake away.
What's that?
The breakaway, it's an old song. I used to sing it as a youth.
Oh.
I did say happy anniversary, didn't I?
I don't know. I can't remember, but you can't overdo a good thing, I always say.
I just don't want to seem to have a single track mind.
Say it.
Hey, come on. Now, you'll bruise me. I bruise.
Say it.
Happy anniversary.
I still haven't got you completely trained,
yeah,
have I?
You're using the right method, though. Loving kindness.
Better than the whip.
Much better.
Honey, what kind of a love song was the breakaway?
Who said with a love song?
You said you sang it in your youth.
I sang Old MacDonald Had a Farm, too. You think I sang that to some dewy female, huh?
Yes, and I hate her.
You could think of the craziest things to brood about.
Well, don't you ever regret the years we weren't together?
Of course I do, darling. Having you with me now makes it easy to forget them.
We are happy, aren't we, Jim?
Hey, what kind of talk is this?
Oh, I don't know. Sometimes I can't help wondering what Oh, what would have become of us if things hadn't worked out the way they did? I mean, suppose you had married Sybil.
What a gruesome thought that is.
Well, you might have.
Who said so?
You must have loved her a little bit.
How many times have I told you that I didn't, not even a little bit?
Well, then why is it she's never been able to get rid of the notion that you did?
Well, don't you ask me to try to explain Sybil, because I can't. I don't even want to try. You tell me what brought this up?
Oh, something Hugh said this evening. He said Sybil still loves you.
Yeah, so Hugh keeps telling us, but I'm beginning to wonder what's eating him.
He's worried about her.
Well, he might be. That's not our worry.
Now he's afraid of what she might do to us.
And what got Hugh on that subject, anyway?
Well, he was trying to explain why he believes Sybil ought to have custody of the baby.
Well, I fail to see the connection.
You see, he feels she'll pull herself together and become more realistic about her future if she had the baby as a... well, as a sort of ballast.
Well, I still don't see what that has to do with this alleged undying love she has for me.
Hugh thinks that unless her natural instincts are allowed to find normal channels, she's just likely to go on being, well, being destructive toward everybody.
Look, she can't harm us, darling. I realize we've been wary about what she might do, but there's nothing she can do to us.
No, maybe not.
Well, I'm sure not.
Oh, darling, I love you so much. If anything should ever happen to us, I don't know what
would
ever...
Nothing will happen to us. Nothing can.
Road of Life. And Dr. Trent, huh?
James
Brent. James Brent.
Dr. James Brent. The tape's a little fuzzy there. We'll get back to our guest, Don McLaughlin, right after this message.
Unexpected financial needs arise at one time or another in everyone's life. And when you need help, it's nice to know that you have friends with whom you can discuss your needs at the Cromwell Savings Bank. Perhaps you need a new automobile. And now is the time to take advantage of those end-of-season price tags. Or your need may be a personal loan to help with bills or medical expenses. If you have a young man or woman who is entering college, you may want to discuss the possibility of an educational loan. Whatever the reasonable need, you'll find a cordial loan officer at Cromwell Savings Bank ready to counsel you and help, if possible. There are now two offices of Cromwell Savings Bank to serve you. The main office, corner of Main and West Streets in Cromwell, and the new Cromwell Plaza office near Kmart. Both offices are open Friday evenings till 9 and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon for your convenience. At either office of Cromwell Savings Bank, they'll be happy to discuss your personal loan needs. And now back to Dick Bertel and Ed Corcoran.
Our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio is Don McLaughlin, who is Chris Hughes on As the World Turns, who was David Harding counter-spy for how many years, Don, do you know?
About 12, I guess, approximately, yeah. 1942 to 1954, maybe, something like that, yeah.
When you were doing that show, did it tend to typecast you so that you weren't as active in other roles or not?
To some extent, yes, yeah. I got sort of the reputation of being a kind of a square-jawed, blue-shirted, upright lead type fellow, and I guess my voice indicates that. So I had mostly that sort of thing to play from then on, I think, actually. And Chris Hughes isn't far from that either.
No, that's true.
I had a friend who was a FBI man, and he said that the fellows at the office kind of got interested in the show, and they would listen to it when they were home on that night, and he said, we really get a kick out of it. He said, you and Harry Peters crouch in a doorway, and in 30 minutes you've got a case solved. And he says, I've been going through every hotel directory in New York City for the last 5 months trying to find somebody. He says, I can't do it in 30 minutes.
Now it takes an hour.
Yeah, that's right.
Anything unusual, untoward ever happened to you in the course of a radio show or that you can think
well,
of?
Well, I don't remember. There's always the terrible fear of fluffing, you know, yeah, of saying something funny. And, of course, there were many of them, some of them that are unprintable or unsayable. But We used to break up when somebody else would do it. If you didn't do it, when you did it yourself, of course, you were embarrassed. It wasn't funny. But yeah. If somebody else did it, it practically nearly. And we were live at that time, you know, and so you couldn't break up. And it was just agony to try to go on. I remember some actress once had something terrible happen. She discovered that there was a foreign agent in her home or something, and she rushed to the telephone and screamed at the operator, "Get me the Scounter Pies." And I tell you, I could hardly answer the phone. It was, but you had to. You had to straighten it. You know how agonizing it is when you want to laugh and can't.
Yeah.
And we had things like that happen all the time. And Ed Begley, remember Ed Begley used to be up here.
Ed had his start here.
Yeah, he got his start here. But he was playing somebody, and he said, "We're gonna cover the Sooth side of Chicago." And I don't, you know, just little things like that. They're not very funny, but when you're on the air, they're hilarious.
That's right. You know, I think in part it's because of the tension.
That's right. You're so uptight that you know you can't laugh, and suddenly you're just in a bind. And some of them were, as I say, I can't repeat them. Some of them, I tell you, it was just agony to keep fighting.
Well, suppose that, when they're reading the scripts, that they miss a line completely, and then it's and you have to come in. How do you handle a situation like that?
Well, you had the script in front of you. You could transpose, or you could pick up the other guy's script if he dropped a page and point out the line to him or something. You'd at least do that. In television, of course, you're just stuck. You're right out there in the open, no script. But with the script in front of you, you were able to you'd transpose. On the other hand, you could make mistakes. I was playing with Ray Johnson one time in some show, and he made a big cut. He jumped clear to the bottom of the page. And I said, "Well, that fool, what's he doing? He didn't get this whole thing straightened out right." Of course, at the end, I found out that he had the cut right, and I didn't, because I tried to go back and cover up, and we got in a real tangle. But those things happen, but I don't think the audience was terribly aware of it.
You know, the audience is very often unaware of the things that we know are going wrong with the program, even today.
Even today on television, things will happen, and I'll ask somebody at home, you know, "Boy, I really blew that when I was up hiring a kite," or something, you know. They say, "I didn't notice it at all," And here I'm thinking I'm going to have a stroke or something. No sweat.
Well, the pressure was even greater on television, isn't it, than it was on radio in a situation like
that's
that.
That's why I said we stole money in those days, because now we earn it. Learning those lines and walking around with your worrying what to do with your hands and so on and so on. It's a lot more work.
Have you ever drawn a blank in the middle of a show where you just everything just kind of left
yes.
you?
Oh, yes. The curtain just comes down right over your eyes. You can't see. You can't think of anything. But we are, we've played together so long that we're very, pretty good at helping each other out, you know, if somebody draws a blank. Of course, there is a teleprompter there for the air show. You have to know your lines up to air, but there is a teleprompter there. But it, strangely enough, always seems to be behind a cameraman or something when you want it, or it's not rolling quite where you thought it was. And so it's kind of tricky. But we have a kind of a good ensemble group to play with, and it's we know about what's happening with each other.
Well, you know, if you just stop to think about that show, as the world turns, Don, you're playing with a bunch of old-time radio actors.
Well, a lot of them, not the whole group, but Santos Ortega, who was the fat man and Inspector, Queen on Ellery Queen. And, he was a man of vast experience in radio, and it's been a pleasure to work with him over these years. He dresses with me. We share the same dressing room, and we're really close friends, and it's been great. And then, of course, Bill Johnstone, who was the Shadow, and one of the big leading men in radio for years and years. Those guys were making so much money when I was breaking in, I used to really resent them. They were big shots.
Did you play before live audiences during the radio days?
Yes, we used to do Death Valley Days, for instance. The agency wanted us to appear in dark jackets and white pants. We looked like the Yale Glee Club or something. And we were playing cowboys and Indians and miners and prospectors in Death Valley Days. I took a friend up once who loved the show, an old fellow that was a friend of mine, and I said, "How'd you like the show?" And he said, "Man," he said, "I'll never see the desert and the mesquite again. All I'll see is you fat guys up there with your blue suits and white pants on and white shoes." Ridiculous, he said, and it was in a way. On the other hand, there's a thing called Roses and Drums where they dressed in Confederate uniforms with clanking swords that would get caught on the microphone and everything. They really took it pretty seriously there, you know.
I had never heard that. I know that Ed Wynn, in the early 40s, took his radio program to so far that they actually created sets for it.
Yes. I
had never heard about this other
one. Yeah, yeah, Roses and Drums. It was a big Civil War series. I can't remember who directed it. It was on just shortly after I started it. I never did play on it, but they went out actually and rented costumes, I understand, because they did have an audience.
Sure. Well, Ed, you have Don's work as a policeman, but not as counter spy yet. We're building up to that. We'll have a counter spy before we're through tonight. But this was one of the great radio programs of the latter years of radio.
Yeah, we spoke about it very often because it captures the flavor of New York City. The actors all have that New York twang about them, and Everett Sloan plays the lead in this. Don plays the part of a judge in 21st Precinct. You remember that show, Don?
Now that you speak of it, I begin to remember it very vaguely because it seemed to me that I remember Everett Sloan playing that part, and I don't know whether it was a Phil Lord show or not, but it was purportedly a really authentic picture of the New York Police Department.
Yeah, I think it was sort of a dragnet, only it was done a little different flavor.
That's right. I think James Gregory played on it a lot, too, as I remember. He was in radio at that
time.
That's
right. So we'll hear you with the black robes now in 21st Precinct.
21st Precinct, Sergeant Klein. Well, who got bitten? Owl? Four. Where's the dog?
You are in the muster room at the 21st Precinct, the nerve center. A call is coming through. You will follow the action taken pursuant to that call from this minute until the final report is written in the 124 room at the 21st Precinct.
All right. You just wait right there in the emergency room. Yes, right there. I'll have an officer come over. Yes. Right away.
21st Precinct. It's just lines on a map of the city of New York. Most of the 173,000 people wedged into the 9/10 of a square mile between Fifth Avenue and the East River wouldn't know if you asked them that they lived or worked in the 21st. Whether they know it or not, the security of their homes, their persons, and their property is the job of the men of the 21st Precinct.
21st Precinct, 160 patrolmen, 11 sergeants, and 4 lieutenants, of whom I'm the boss. My name is Kennelly, Frank Kennelly. I'm captain in command of the 21st. Sergeant Burns told me that Patrolman Mercado had come upon a boy, 17, in the act of turning in a false alarm. He chased him up the stairs of a tenement and over the roofs of 3 adjacent buildings before he was apprehended. The boy admitted turning in at least 5 false alarms during the last month. I went on patrol of the precinct, during which I stopped on post number 2, saw Patrolman Mercado, and congratulated him on the arrest. Later, while I was still on patrol, there was a radio signal to call in. We stopped at the nearest box, and I was told by Sergeant Klein that a visitor was waiting for me, Judge Charles Whitney. I had my operator drive me around to the precinct house. When I got out of the car, I instructed him to pick up his partner, who had been taking his meal period, and resume patrol. As the car drove away, I crossed the sidewalk and walked up into the muster room. Hello, Sergeant.
Captain.
21st Precinct, Sergeant.
Where's
Klein?
The judge? I suggested the judge
all
wait
right.
in your office, Captain.
You take your meal.
Good.
All right.
Well, what's doing, Sergeant?
Oh, it's been a quiet tour, Captain.
All right, I'll be in my office.
Yes, sir.
21st Precinct, Sergeant Klein. Broke into what?
Judge Whitney.
Oh, hello, Captain. We've met before, haven't we?
Yes, I think so, at some dinner.
Oh, yeah.
Well, sit down, Judge.
Thank you. I just got into LaGuardia from Boston an hour ago.
Yes, sir, I know.
I understand you were over to the apartment, Captain.
Yes, that's right. We were there. And I'm sorry if we found it necessary to be a little insistent with Mrs. Whitney, but I don't have to tell you the law in these dogbite cases, Judge. If I wasn't able to effect service the way I did, I would have been required to get a warrant and break the door down. I hope you were able to explain that to Mrs. Whitney.
Captain, I haven't been able to explain anything to Mrs. Whitney. She wouldn't open the door for me, either.
Wouldn't she?
No. I came home from the airport and went upstairs and tried my key, and she had the chain on the door. Wouldn't open it. Wouldn't even talk to me. The building manager came upstairs and told me what had happened.
Well, I'm sorry, Judge.
Well, it's not your fault, Captain. I don't blame you. I should have seen it coming. Perhaps I even knew it was coming, and I couldn't bring myself to believe it.
What's that, sir?
A breakdown. I should have seen it the night I left for Boston. That was the same night that Jeff bit the child.
Oh?
He's a boxer, you know, so we named him James J. Jeffries, Jeff for short. Mm-hmm. I told her before I left that she would probably be called upon to deliver the dog for observation. And I should have seen from her attitude then that this was going to happen. I was in a hurry to catch the plane. She was all right until then. I understand she was fine when the dog bit the child, that she took the mother and the child to the emergency room, paid the bill, so forth.
Yes, that's the report we got, too.
But the minute I mentioned the possibility she might have to turn Jeff over for observation, she changed.
What was the reason for the change, you know, Judge?
Yes, I do. I think I do. See, Captain, we had two sons, Richard and Charles Jr. They were a year and a half apart, 19 and 20. They were in school at Yale. Last June, they were driving down to New York after school. Their car turned over on the Merritt Parkway. They were both killed. Both of them.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Judge.
If you have children of your own, you can imagine what it did to us. We went away, but that didn't help. Nothing helped. For myself, I found escape in my work. A judge can work hard, you know, and I did. But Nora didn't have anything like work, I suppose she... She turned to the dog, because Jeff was the boy's dog. When she saw the possibility that she'd lose the dog, that brought it on. I'm sure that that's the answer.
Well, it probably is, yes, sir.
She wouldn't even open the door. She doesn't even trust me.
If I'd have known what the circumstances were, perhaps we could have used some other means.
There wasn't any way for you to know, Captain. I'm not worried about that now. She's locked up in there alone. That's what I'm worried about. I don't know what's preying on her mind.
Well, if you want to go into the apartment, Judge, I can call the emergency squad to give us a hand. They have a way with doors,
yes,
you know.
But that's only as a last resort. No, I'd like to try persuasion some more. I had the door open this wide, the same as you did. I called to her. She wouldn't answer. When I couldn't think of anything else to say or do, I came over here. Do you have any ideas, Captain, besides the emergency squad, I mean?
Well, perhaps I have one, just one. It might work, I don't know.
Anything, Captain. I'm willing to try anything.
The judge in 21st Precinct, Don McLaughlin, our guest, and we'll get back to his story right after this message.
Since 1871, Cromwell Savings Bank has been the friendly bank, the dependable bank, striving to make it as easy as possible for you to save. With six different savings plans to accommodate you, Cromwell Savings Bank assures personal attention to your particular banking needs. And there's a new branch to the old family tree located on the Cromwell Plaza. This Cromwell Savings Bank Plaza office is open Monday through Thursday, 10 to 4:30 p.m., Friday, 10 to 7:30 p.m., and Saturdays, 9 to noon. You'll find the same friendly and reliable banking service at the Cromwell Plaza office that's been in their family for over 100 years. Start your new savings account at either Cromwell Savings Bank office and know that your finances are in good hands. Cromwell's main office is located at the corner of Main and West Streets and is conveniently open Monday through Wednesday from 9 a.m. to 3, Thursday from 9 to 5, Fridays from 9 to 7:30 p.m., and Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 12 noon. Cromwell Savings Bank, serving Connecticut people since 1871. They'd like to serve you, too. Now back to Dick Bertel and Ed Corcoran.
Don McLaughlin is our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio. And Don, you had to, certainly had to work with Phillips H. Lord because he produced Counterspy. Yes, did you start off with him on Gangbusters?
No, I started off with him in Counterspy. He auditioned a lot of people, and actually House Jameson had played the role for the first one, but House was a man of impeccable diction. He had a beautiful stage voice. And Phil Lord thought that it was a little bit too stagey, I guess, for what he wanted. So he auditioned a lot of people, and I came up with a great Midwestern voice, and he said, that's it. So I started, and I remember I took the package to William Morris Agency, and I said, you better represent me in this because we're going to start a series. And Phil called me up and said, we don't need agents. And he was a tough horse trader for me. And I said, you may not need an agent. When I'm dealing with you, I need an agent. Well, I didn't get all the money I might have, but I did all right with him and played it for over 10 years. And he was a funny man to work for. He was very meticulous. We would do we'd do a complete run through, and then we'd all assemble in his office and listen to it very carefully, and he'd have every word practically. He'd have some correction to make. And the sound effects, as I mentioned, is was sort of his specialty. And he would rehearse those sound people. And, of course, those days they handled live guns and gravel pits and running feet and stomping around and breaking chairs. And whatever it was practically done right there. And he would rehearse those people they were ready to drop. But that was his trademark, was the... And we have the phrase coming on like gangbusters is just part of our language now, which that was what he created.
That's right. You were indicating earlier that several FBI people would listen to Counterspy and would chuckle at the way you were able to solve stories in 30 minutes. What was the concept of Counterspy?
Well, I think that my own feeling about it is that Phil Lord, we were going into the war, and there was a lot of worrying about the perils that were imminent, and the Japanese were going to land on the West Coast, and this, that, and the other. And I think Phil Lord had a very sound idea. He wanted a kind of a hero figure, but he, now Mr. D.A., for instance, which Phil created, I believe, originally, was a local man. He handled local crimes and everything. But Phil Lord, I think, wanted to give a kind of a Robin Hood, maybe, or not exactly that, but some kind of a folk hero that would be able almost single-handed to thwart the terrible enemy forces that were descending on us. And he hit on this idea of an agency which didn't even exist in the government, really, but was he made it up to be the savior of our country. And he embodied it all in David Harding and his sidekick, Harry Peters. The two of us, we had a couple of agents that once in a while worked for us, but we generally solved all these things single-handed.
I'm just trying to think about Peters. Was Mandel Kramer?
Yeah, Mandel Kramer, yeah.
He played that part, yeah.
Yeah. He wasn't in, there's one tape that I have that he's not in it. That was prior to his being in the cast. I don't remember exactly when he came in, but he was in for most of the run.
Mm.
And a very dear friend, and
yeah,
we became bosom buddies.
Well, how long was the show
winning
on the
war single-handed?
Yeah,
double-handed. What the?
How long was the show on the air?
About 12 years. It finally, at the end, it became rather pointless because we had won the war, and it was all over. And to have David Harding running around finding smugglers or something like that, it was really not very pertinent to the scene, so it just finally kind of died out.
This was in
the early 50s, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Did Korea have any effect on
that? No, I don't think we dealt with Korea at all.
It wasn't like World War II.
We didn't. David Harding wasn't needed for Korea because they weren't coming at us that hard.
I was just going to say, other than David Harding, did you have any favorite character that
I wish we could have some scene from Chaplain Jim, which was a marvelous show during the war. It sounds funny. I mean, the soldiers always kind of, I guess, made fun of the chaplain a little bit in camps and so on and so on. But this show was written by some very good writers, and it was really, I think, quite cogent at that time to the boys being in the service and the problems they had. And it was really an excellent show, and I was quite happy to do it. I felt like I never got any money for it. It was just done at scale, but it was a kind of an effort, something for the war, and I was quite happy with it.
With the Chaplain Jim, did he play all the different services, or how did you adjust?
No,
to
I
the
was in the
European
army.
In the army, in the European theater.
European theater. Yeah, and I think went over when we wound up in Europe and went west. I think he took a couple of shots at the islands or something. I can't remember. But it was, for the most part, and Roosevelt died at that time. We had a special memorial service and got some kind of commendation from the White House. It was kind of a serious program at that time.
Do any Chaplain Jims exist?
I've been trying ever since I talked to Don about coming on the show, and they just don't seem to be in existence. But if we find one, I was certainly.
I don't ever know what happened to any of those. Of course, they were all on wax then. They were all on records then in those days, and I guess they could very easily be. I don't know where they would be. I haven't any idea. And then I did play a part that I had a lot of fun called Tennessee Jed. I don't know whether that was very. Very popular around here or not, but
I remember Tennessee Jed.
It was marvelous, and a real cowboy. I always wanted to play a cowboy, and this was beautiful.
This was a children's show.
Yeah, it was an afternoon show for kids, and you know, shots ricocheting off and everything. It was beautiful. We had a lot of fun with that.
Well, we're going to hear from David Harding, Counterspy.
Yes, this is one of my favorite episodes, and it does feature Mandel Kramer as well as yourself, and we'll see how you actually won World War II.
Pepsi-Cola presents Counter Spy. Washington calling David Harding, Counter Spy. Washington calling David Harding, Counter Spy.
Harding, Counter Spy, calling Washington.
United States Counter Spies, especially appointed to investigate and combat the enemies of our country, both at home and abroad. Tonight, the case of the Crystalline Double Cross, a thrilling counter-spy report to the American people. Brought to you each Tuesday and Thursday by delicious Pepsi-Cola. Two weeks ago, in the vault of the New York jewel dealers, Lamar and Moffitt, the Crystalline Diamond, an official gift to the United States from the Rajah of Subgun, sparkled under the harsh light of a hanging lamp. A tall man of 45 with iron gray hair and horn-rimmed glasses, Arthur Lamar bent over the jewel, lost in wonder. Suddenly, behind him, out of the darkness, came another figure, swift, silent, with upraised arm. A pause, and then... Counter-spy field offices. Last night, the Crystalline Diamond of Subgun was stolen from the New York jewel firm of Lamar and Moffitt. All authorities are warned to be on the lookout.
Anne, darling, frightened?
Of course I am, Victor. You and I are running away. I feel as if the whole country were after us.
I hope you'll never be sorry that you've come with me.
Never. This is the big adventure of my life, Victor.
Just you keep thinking that way, Anne. Only even big adventures have to be planned.
I've put myself in your hands.
Where we're driving to, for instance.
Well, where?
You know, for several years I've taken vacations. But did you notice that I've never told anyone where I've been?
That's right, you didn't.
I went regularly to the little California town of Oceanside. I lived there and became known as John Robertson, an Eastern businessman. Now you will appear there as the new Mrs. Robertson.
How easy you make it sound.
Far from it. But I always knew that someday I'd need John Robertson. The day that I couldn't stand another minute of my dear partner, Arthur Lamar. And this time John Robertson and wife will stay in Oceanside quietly for a year. Maybe two?
Not too quietly, Victor. I've had years of that.
Oh, I think I can promise you it won't be too quiet. Not when Arthur finds out about,
What?
Me. When he finds out what his partner has really done to him. I'd love to see his face.
Gentlemen of the press, I'm Arthur Lamar. Very sorry to have kept you waiting, but I was delayed by further police and insurance company investigation and by a little more medical attention for the blow on the head that I received last night. I think you all know the main facts. The Crystalline Diamond, the most perfect jewel in the world, was stolen last night from the vault of Lamar and Moffitt by my partner, Victor Moffitt. But now I have a special announcement. I am personally offering a reward for the capture of Victor Moffitt. $50,000 alive, $100,000 dead. blank paper, please.
There you go.
What? Hey, taxi. Counter spy headquarters, please.
Peters, the moment I saw the paper, I rushed here to headquarters for further information.
Mr. Harding, you knew about the theft of the crystalline diamond yesterday.
I mean this reward for Victor Muffet. 50,000 alive, 100,000 dead. That's the stupidest thing I've seen in years.
Take it easy, Dave. You'll burn a bearing.
Diamond is national property, but normally we wouldn't have to worry about it. Police and insurance investigators are able to take care of it. But this reward... I'm going to New York and see Arthur Lamar. With all due respect, Mr. Lamar, I'm afraid you were very upset when you announced this reward.
I was, Mr. Harding. I still am. Why, we were entrusted with that diamond on its way to Washington, and my firm has been made to look untrustworthy. But, Mr. Harding, why are you so upset about this yourself?
Mr. Lamar, it's the nature of the reward you're offering for Moffat. 50,000 alive, well and good. But to offer twice as much for him dead... That's an invitation to murder.
Murder?
By elements in the underworld. Unscrupulous individuals who see a chance to collect a great deal of money for committing a crime.
Good heavens, I never thought of it that way.
Besides, you put Moffat on notice, he may be shot to death without a chance, without a trial.
Chance? A trial? He's as guilty as he can be.
Mr. Lamar, a man like Moffat doesn't usually carry weapons. He's not a killer, a professional gunman. That means he could easily be taken alive. But now you've made sure that capturing him will cost blood.
But he must be armed, Mr. Harding. A gun I kept at home is missing.
In any case, will you withdraw that reward, Mr. Lamar?
Mr. Harding, am I violating any law by posting the reward for Moffat, alive or dead?
Frankly, no.
Then I will not withdraw it.
May I ask you frankly, Mr. Lamar, what purely personal motive leads you to want to see Moffat dead?
I've said nothing to the press about this, Mr. Harding. But Victor Moffat fled in the company of a woman. My wife.
Shouldn't we be on U.S. Highway 22A?
We are, darling.
We just passed a sign saying this is Pennsylvania 101B.
Same thing, Ann. Relax.
Oh, I was just thinking, how many more states to California?
Here's a little town, or the edge of one. You hungry?
That was an enormous lunch we had.
Well, still, it's late. Suppose we find a nice motor court, and then I'll get in some food for a light supper.
Fine.
David Harding, counter spy, and played, of course, by our guest tonight, Don McLaughlin. We'll get back to Don right after this.
When you send the youngsters off to school each year, do you ever envision the day you'll send them off to college? College may still be a distant dream, but you can help finance it with today's savings. Cromwell Savings Bank offers you a choice of six convenient savings plans. Pick the one that's best tailored to suit your needs. There's Cromwell Savings' six-year certificate of deposit, paying an annual interest rate of 7.75% with an effective yield per annum of 8.17%. The minimum deposit is $1,000. Or for short-term savings, there's a four-year certificate of deposit. Your friends at Cromwell Savings will be glad to sit down with you and explain all six of their savings plans. Under federal regulations, certificates of deposit may not be redeemed before maturity without a penalty charge being imposed. Get all the details while you get started on a savings plan at Cromwell Savings Bank, with two convenient locations, at the corner of Main and West Streets and also on the Cromwell Plaza. Cromwell Savings, with two friendly banks in a friendly town. Member FDIC. Now back to Dick Bertel and Ed Corcoran with tonight's special guest, Don McLaughlin.
Don, I have certainly enjoyed sharing your radio career with us. Have you done anything other than Chris Hughes on television, or Have you stayed pretty much
for
that show?
We did Road of Life for 26 weeks, and I played Jim Brand on that was my first television. I've only done two television shows, and they're both daytime. And Road of Life for 26 weeks, I believe it was, and then Chris Hughes for 26 years.
Yeah, it seems that maybe it was premature because these doctor shows have caught on and they're very popular, both daytime and nighttime now. You think it would
Yes, it might have, but it was always in the format of a soap opera. It didn't have kind of the institutional monolithic thing that, you know, the Marcus Welby or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. It could have, if it had been, as you say, lucky, you might have done it.
You have your own operating room on the set and all that.
Yeah, we used to have that. I cut myself with a scalpel.
Don, would you ever like to, if it were possible, get back in radio?
This job on television is a tough job. I mean, people do other things, like go back on the stage and play every night and do this in the daytime, but they're a lot younger than I am, and I don't really have any great desire to do it, no. I think I'd be very nervous. I thought when I left radio and come into television, I thought I would, pass out from nerves, and now I think if I went back the other way, I'd be shaking the script and having an awful time. But no, seriously, I don't really care. I'm very busy with what I'm doing, and I think I'll just let it go at that.
I'm sure that's the case. Don McLaughlin, I want to thank you very much for being our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio. And until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
Rogers in the 25th century.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Bank, located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell and near Kmart at the new Cromwell Plaza office, a friendly bank in a friendly town. The Golden Age of Radio was recorded by Bob Sherrago, produced by Bill Grasty and Dick Bertel.
Graham McNamee. And Edwin, the fire chief.